Hello and welcome to Fast Forward, presented by Commotion, your regular glimpse into the future of urban mobility. As always, I'm your host, Greg Lindsay, Director of Strategy for Commotion, and as always, I'm joined by Jonah Bliss, VP of Media and Marketing for Commotion. It's spring, Jonah. How are you feeling?
Spring has sprung. I'm feeling good, Greg. How about yourself?
I am feeling good myself, but not as good as you, because you, my friend, have received your first jab. I am envious here on this side of the border.
No side effects yet, other than a slightly sore arm, but who knows? By the time this airs, I could be keeled over. But bad joke. Everyone go get your vaccines. It's great.
There are no side effects. There are no downsides, my dear listeners. Go get vaccinated as soon as you can. I wish I could here in Montreal, where the EU's follies are to our detriment, to say the least.
All I can say, Greg, is that I'm just, you know, so pleased to see the U.S. succeeding at something even vaguely, you know, publicly minded and collectively oriented for once. So yay. Thanks, Biden.
It is. It's a very American story. Completely fail at every aspect of it except the end, in which you can claim victory. It's a very American way.
Just throw money at the problem.
And, exactly. All our troubles. Well, I would say, speaking of spring, at the very end of this spring is, of course, the upcoming Commotion Miami, and we're very excited. We've had done formal announcement of this year's event, and along with Commotion Miami is, of course, Commotion Lab. So, Jonah, talk us through. We launched this a year ago at the first installment of Commotion Miami Live, and now we have some task forces and other fun things to talk about. So, what's the big news?
Yeah, it's been a big week for Commotion announcements. So, anyone that's following the tech and transportation scene in the Magic City has got a lot to celebrate. So first, you know, Commotion Lab Miami, which is, you know, the lab is meant to really be kind of like a testing ground, a proving ground where tech partners and government entities can work together to kind of accelerate rollouts and progress and try new things. So we launched the first task force is one that's focused on UAM, urban air mobility, and the other one that's sort of on smart curbs and smart infrastructure. So I think two really important hot spaces, two spaces where Miami and Florida in general are looking to lead the way. So excited to see what work those two come out with in the year to come. And then the other bit of news is that the second edition of the Miami Mobility Challenge has also launched, this time in partnership with iStreet. So any budding entrepreneur, student, tinkerer, someone with a cool mobility idea, head to the Commotion Miami website and shoot over your application, because it's going to be another fun one. You have to work with local partners in Florida. And if you have a great idea, not only do you get it on the stage in front of, you know, smart people that can make it a success, but you can work with government entities to really put the rubber to the road, so to speak.
And it's a very fun, because I would say one of the things we've always prided ourselves on in Commotion is not just, you know, doing a conference in a ballroom, not just doing a trade show on a trade floor, but like doing actual projects out in the world, inviting participants to test drive things. Obviously, Commotion Miami will be an interesting hybrid event this year. We're still figuring out exactly the right mix of in-person versus virtuals, given, you know, rolling vaccinations and giving, you know, the state of Florida there. But it's great to see that, like, you know, having tangible projects again with, you know, with actual teams there. It's really exciting. So, and now with, of course, C-Lab, you know, as we call it, you know, actually sort of bringing this coalition of partners to bear on public problems. So very, very excited to see it, especially as Florida becomes, you know, ground zero of urban air mobility in the states, among other things, which I think, as we've touched upon in the past, always has been, you know, John Travolta hiding out there with his 707 somewhere in the swamps. Always personal air mobility has been a hallmark of Florida. So
when will we get Travolta to headline a Commotion event?
As soon as we plant that idea in John Rossant's head. So look, we'll have to see what we can do that for next year. So, Jonah, what other news do we have this week? And who is our guest? I believe you handle those duties this time around.
Yes, we actually have two guests. A lot of fun talking about EVs and the kind of venture space. So Camille Terry, co-founder and CEO of a company called Charger Help, and our good friend from Lacey, Alex Mitchell, who's their SVP of Unlocking Innovation. So a fun chat. Listen in a bit.
Great. All right. So what do we have in store this week for our listeners?
I think we should start with a little bit of a wild card news. That's why you listen to us, folks. Fast forward. We're not just doing the easy ones, but there was a big SCOTUS case that just, you know, got settled and ruled in Google's favor. So it was Google versus Oracle, and it was all about APIs. And basically the ruling was that Google could fairly, you know, it was within their right of fair use to basically reuse and reinterpret code that Sun had used for Java. And I think if I recall correctly, this was basically back in the nascent days of Android, they used some of the same kind of framework so that it was easier for people to write Android programs. And so it turns out it's legal.
Which is really interesting in like a number of respects, obviously. Like number one, like, you know, fair use is almost like never used this broadly in tech circles. Like, you know, we're like, I mean, when I was a Cub reporter covering the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, it was all about, you know, could you actually write software of your own to read back digital media files? And mm-hmm. the court at the time argued like, no, like the companies actually owned the tools themselves. So this is really interesting in that respect. And two, like, yeah, the notion of like, you know, I mean, as many of our listeners no doubt know, like the way the big tech stacks fight each other is to open up APIs and allow a thousand flowers bloom. And then once they get big enough that it's no longer to their advantage, like wipe out the APIs. This notion that you could, if you have the code, reconstruct the API, which, you know, maybe it was out on GitHub at one point and use that to access functionality is really interesting. Not just for like, of course, like, you know, the big tech companies out there and ride hailing and open up APIs into each other's businesses, but also, you know, of course, things like our friends at LADOT and MDS and everything else. So it'll, I don't know exactly the mobility implications as of to date, but that is really interesting. The notion that, you know, that you can pry back open some functionality into somebody else's thing. And the Supreme Court has ruled that that is considered a fair use play. Well, that's another interesting wrinkle for the mobility landscape, say the least. Yeah.
No, I mean, I like this. I'm firmly more on the more open is better standpoint in terms of copyright and fair use. So sorry, Disney. But I think from a mobility standpoint, yeah, it's. I think this could really see a further flourishing of a lot of the kind of the layers of software that undergird a lot of the solutions that we just take for granted. So the fact that, you know, so many of your mobility apps, you know, run on top of Google Maps. So if another player made it easier to basically use the same code but with a different mapping software, we might see more innovation in that space. And I'm sure there's, you know, tons of examples that I can't even think of yet because, you know, that's why we're not rich, Greg. But I think making it easier to innovate, it's only going to help this kind of continued Cambrian explosion of mobility startups.
SCOTUS, the ultimate disruptor. There you go. well, what do we got this week in SPACs, Jonah? We're going to miss the SPAC boom when it's over, and it's almost over, isn't it?
It does seem like it's slowing down. So we kind of got two bits of contradictory information. On one hand, there's reports that, you know, individual investors, retail investors, you know, the diamond hands on Reddit are kind of cooling their interest in this nascent sport. So maybe as the world is reopening and there's more things you can do that aren't just sitting in front of your computer, people are less interested in pouring money into their trading accounts. But on the flip side, we do have a gigantic SPAC coming up. Which one's that, Greg?
Well, that was the Financial Times breaking the news as of press time that that Grab, you know, the big Southeast Asian ride-hailing giant, is about to go public through a $35 billion valuation SPAC with Altimeter Capital, which, you know, another one of the groups out there. But that's really interesting. I mean, you know, again, consolidation of the global landscape sort of has left it with, of course, you know, the Uber-Lyft duopoly in North America, Didi in China, of course. Grab seems to have sort of, you know, consolidated its lead in Southeast Asia. And Ola is a bit more of a minor player in India to some extent, or a smaller one. So interesting. So this is, you know, Grab reasserting its destiny here. And $35 billion, you know, it's, you know, not as big a pop as some of the other ones got on the U.S. Exchanges, but still pretty solid. So perhaps there is life in that SPAC bubble yet. Or perhaps they're just getting slightly more selective. I don't know. I'm curious to know how many more targets can be bagged and whether this signals the next phase of the SPAC bubble, which is to throw even more money at the problem and hunt down bigger companies.
Well, and I think it is kind of interesting, and maybe it shows the limits of a SPAC, is that even though the valuation is $35 billion, they're only raising $2.5 billion, mm-hmm. only in scare quotes. And of that, only $1.2 billion is from the actual SPAC. So I assume the $1.3 is from like a pipe or something. But yeah, there's... You know, in terms of tech behemoths, if you said you're only going to raise that much money in your actual, you know, initial going to the public markets, it's actually not a crazy amount of money compared to, you know, what we've seen from others back in the day. So it does sort of seem like there's a kind of cap in how much money you can actually stuff in that SPAC. And the only thing I'll also add is that I think it's kind of interesting that they chose to list on the NYSE, even though they're, you know, as you said, a Southeast Asian focused company, so kind of a snub towards some of the local exchanges.
That's true. It is an interesting.
Actually, you know what? No, I know it's because I think SPACs still to this day are largely an American phenomenon. Because I remember we talked about, you know, the London Stock Exchange thinking about if they wanted to loosen their rules to make it SPAC easier there, and so I assume maybe the Singapore and Hong Kong markets are not so spectastic.
Well, in that case, they have missed out there. So the Nikkei is just kicking itself if that's the case. Well, let's see that. So to bring us beyond SPACs then, that brings us, it's been interesting, some interesting developments in autonomy or lack thereof. I know we got a couple bullet points in this that we're going to discuss. I want to bring up the one I think it's really interesting that Jalopnik has ruled in its editorial standards that any references to a certain company's quote unquote full self-driving will be referred to as often as possible as a level two automated driver assistance system, not anything implying anything more. And so that, I thought that was interesting in and of itself to see, you know, some journalistic rigor applied to the untested claims of certain companies. But what else do we have in the world of autonomy this week?
Well, you know, I suppose if we're really trying to emulate a human driver, it's important that the car does still get in a few fender benders, just to make everyone, you know, feel like, oh, familiar. But back in Phoenix, our old testing ground for all sorts of AV shenanigans, a Waymo vehicle got in a little fender bender. And so it's, you know, I don't think there was anything catastrophic, fortunately, but I think it continues to show that, yeah, this isn't that easy a challenge. You know, maybe it is rocket science after all. It's pretty hard to make a flawless vehicle out there in the real world.
Well, and related to that, I would say perhaps in some small measure of cause and effect, Waymo's John Krafcik, has stepped down as CEO after, I believe, 5 years at the helm. No announced plans, no, you know, rumors of internal strife. It just seems that, yeah, they're running a $30 billion autonomous car company that has yet to produce a fully autonomous car and full-fledged business model at scale, perhaps that wears you down after a while. So already some speculation about where he'll land or what he'll end up doing next, but interesting to see that, you know, the leader of the most respected AV startup out there choosing to exit at this time when supposedly, when they are actually in the commercial market. So it'll be interesting to see who's going to try to push them forward from here.
Yeah, I mean, it's, as you said, it's interesting because Waymo is certainly the leader in this space, and it's been under Krafcik's, you know, purview. But at the same time, you know, a few years ago, they were saying they'd have 82,000 vehicles on the road by now. And I think right now the count is around 600. And so yeah, 600 is slightly smaller than 82,000. But at the same time, you know, that's more vehicles than anyone else has out there. So it's just shows how tricky this space is. I can only imagine. it can't be an easy job. So, I'm sure he's saying spending more time with, you know, friends and family and hobbies or something, as they always say, but that probably sounds pretty good.
That's true, Joe. I had forgotten all those Chrysler Pacificas and Jaguar I-Paces that were supposed to have conquered the world by now under Waymo's banner, but I guess. Poor Fiat Chrysler and Jaguar Land Rover. Well, good. Well, I think that takes us to our guest this week, Jonah. So welcome him on.
Yeah, let's hear from Alex and Camille. So we're here today with Camille Terry, the co-founder and CEO of Charger Help, and Alex Mitchell, the Senior Vice President of Unlocking Innovation at LACI, or the LA Cleantech Incubator. You might know LACI from being a longtime friend and partner of Commotion's. But I'm really excited about this. We're going to talk about two very cool kind of developments for both organizations and then get into, you know, thoughts and prognostications about the wild world of EVs. So welcome to the show, guys.
Hey, how's it going?
Yeah. And hey, Alex.
Thank you so much for having me, Joan. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah. I'm excited too. But why don't we start, Camille, can you maybe give us a little brief bio on Charger Help?
Sure. So Charger Help, we're putting people in charging stations back to work. What that means is that, you know, we've been deploying a lot of infrastructure out there across the United States. And that infrastructure needs folks to be out there to fix them if they break down or clean them and ensure that drivers can always get a charge. And that's what we're doing over at Charger Help.
That sounds good to me. And I think I know you guys had some exciting news recently. What just happened the other week?
Well, due to our, you know, our success in regards to customer relationships, we've been able to secure some funding in order to expand to support more charging stations. So we're really excited that the industry has backed us both on the investment side, but most importantly on the customer side.
Yeah, and you're being very modest. So congratulations!
Thank you.
Just for the listeners out there, $2.75 million. And for you mobility dorks out there, like just a great list of VCs. You've got Trucks, Kapoor Capital, JFF, a long list. I won't read them all out, but I mean, for a company that I think you only started beginning of 2020, right? That's a pretty impressive trajectory. So congrats to you.
Thank you so much. Yeah, thanks for calling out the number too. We're really, they talk about like, just don't get too excited about the investment because now we got to turn that in and make more money.
Flee to Bermuda or something, no?
Right. But definitely want to give a huge shout out to Lacey because a lot of those connections and just know how to navigating raising money came through, you know, working inside of their program. So we're extremely grateful.
I actually think, Camille, that Trux met you for the first time at Power Day, sort of our annual portfolio pitch event, is when you first got on Trux radar screen. So it's sort of great to see an event like Power Day turn into then your seed lead investor.
Yes, no, absolutely. That actually is, I didn't even remember that.
You better be writing that case study right now.
Well, who knows? Maybe you will see at Power Day this coming year, Camille and Riley from Trux sort of sharing what they've been working on together. Who knows?
I'd watch that. But I will say, I mean, I think you nailed on the only reason that Camille's not just taking the money and running is because you're on the phone, Alex, and this is an amazing Lacey success story. So we don't want to run off with Lacey's money either. But I think Charger Help was one of your cohort one models, and you guys actually just a couple weeks ago also had some big news where you announced cohort two. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. So just for folks listening who don't know Lacey particularly well, Lacey, Los Angeles Clean Tech Incubator, we are a nonprofit clean tech incubator located in downtown Los Angeles with a mission to create an inclusive green economy. And we do that in three tech priority areas. So zero emissions mobility, clean energy, and then sustainable cities with a pretty strong focus on circular economy. And so we made a journey together with startups a year ago, year plus, transitioning to a cohort-based model. And so Camille was one of the, again, founding members of Cohort One. And then just last week, we launched Cohort Two. So an additional group of about 13 companies, again, across zero emissions, mobility, clean energy, and circular economy. Who are excited to make just as much progress as Cohort One companies in scaling clean tech and in particular sustainable mobility.
And without playing any favorites, but can you give us some highlights or just particular companies that have made that cohort?
Well, rather than doing like really companies to look out for, I'll tell you themes that came across this time, and some of these themes already started becoming apparent with Camille's cohort. And are just being sort of amplified with cohort two. You know, if you think about clean tech, a lot of people used to think of clean tech as synonymous with hard tech, moonshots kind of stuff. And obviously that still plays a very important role in clean tech. So we incubated Ampere, an electric plane manufacturer. They just announced their acquisition by Surf Air. And that still like really plays an important role in clean tech. But we find ourselves with two sort of interesting phenomenon that are happening in terms of businesses and business models. One is because, we're sort of, you might call it clean tech 2.0 era, we now have an incredible number of types of businesses that can be launched on top of existing assets. Those are software businesses, those are marketplaces, and Charger Help is a great example of that, right? They're not building chargers themselves. They're saying, actually, we're going to serve as a layer on top of some of this charging infrastructure and make it just operate a lot better. So an example of somebody in cohort two who's building on top of businesses on top of those assets is ChargeNet, which is a software solutions provider that really helps fast food restaurants unify all their assets, whether it's solar charging or EV charging, with their point of sale material and software. So you can imagine how powerful it would be for somebody to be standing in line at McDonald's and to realize that the person ahead of them not only ordered a Big Mac, but just ordered a 30 minutes of range for their EV to get while they consume their Big Mac. And how
with
much
a side of fries.
And how much that can expand the marketplace over time for in terms of awareness and innovation. So like that's a software-based model that continues to prove that clean tech is not just about hardware, but it's really all about software and services. And the other trend that became apparent with cohort one and is getting reinforced is the notion of job creation. So 5 years ago, it was seven years ago, it was very trendy in venture to just say, this is the gig version for this. And we're now seeing some of the backlash against that coming from a couple of different directions. One is on the government side of folks, you know, in the Biden stimulus policy really does have a focus on good job creation. And you're also seeing it from the consumer sentiment side, you know, Amazon and others sort of being on the back foot when some people claim, hey, this sort of job creation is not necessarily quality jobs when you have headlines about delivery folks not even being able to take a restroom break. And so ChargerHelp has obviously a really good focus on creating good quality jobs in the community. And that's reinforced by cohort two. So an example of that is Plus, which is a micromobility manufacturer, really thinking about how to create a local good jobs component, right? Historically on micromobility, the value chain sort of allowed the community to be an end user of micromobility, but not always engaged in things like repurpose and remanufacturing, things like that. So two big trends I would say is just the proliferation of types of businesses that are clean tech, not just hardware, but also services, software, marketplaces, all that. And then a much more concerted thinking around, are these businesses creating jobs and are they creating good jobs?
Yeah, no, I mean, that's great to hear. And I feel like, I mean, that's sort of what makes Lacey, you know, different from your run-of-the-mill incubator, your sort of, you know, legacy and connections to the city, to LADWP. And I think that's so great that you guys, and yeah, obviously your portfolio company, so, you know, ChargerHelp, that you're, you know, making jobs here, and it's not just jobs for people that happen to be amazing coders, but people that have, you know, other skills and abilities in the world. And, you know, not everyone needs to code, but it's also a skill to know how to fix a charger or build a scooter or do all sorts of other things that require, you know, skills and job training and invigorate the local economy. So that's,
yeah,
that's
super, I mean, cool. Put another way, no, I'm a dog owner myself, but I don't think the world needs like a fifth dog walking app.
I'm gonna delete that pitch deck I was about to shoot you over. But
if you're gonna devote yourself as an entrepreneur to like all the risk and all that it takes, the blood, sweat, and tears of being an entrepreneur, or if you're gonna invest in somebody as a VC, or if you're gonna incubate somebody as an incubator, like make it matter too. Don't just make it, you know, a startup for the sake of being a startup, but make it, you know, for the sake that it actually matters as well. And I just don't get that same feeling from the fifth dog walking app as I do about something like what ChargerHelp is doing.
Mm-hmm. We're running out of synonyms for, you know, barking and woofing anyways. Camille, I'm curious. I mean, it seems like you've been kind of in the Lacey universe for about as long as ChargerHelp's been around now. So, you know, what has that experience been like? You know, give me some dirt on Alex. But more importantly, you know, what are some things that other, you know, entrepreneurs can kind of learn from your experience, or any kind of interesting insights you could share?
Yeah, it's funny because I feel like we've almost been a part of like every incubator, accelerator program there is like in LA. So this is it's a good viewpoint.
Play in the field.
Yeah, well, you know, someone like, I'm from South Central Los Angeles, and like I didn't really have, like, my dad started his own company, but he never had had support. And so when I thought about doing tech and starting this company, I just knew I needed people that knew how to properly build a business. And so that's why we applied to literally everything, because I was like, we're going to find help somewhere. But the thing that I've seen that Lacey does well, and the actually kind of better than anyone else, are two things. The first is definitely their focus on having an advisor. So my advisor is Mr. John Siegler. Shout out to John if he's out there. And he's been just so influential in ChargerHelp, specifically having someone that has like run a business before, sold businesses, raised money. It allows you to navigate through those pitfalls. And Lacey's FBA program and their incubation program really focuses heavily on partnering startup founders with these advisors in a different way that I've seen in other programs. And so that's been extremely helpful. And then the other thing that has been really important to the growth of Charger Hope has been their focus on incubation pilots. So actually getting funding to run it a pilot and partner with a, you know, a customer helped us not only prove out our proof of concept, but to really say like, hey, we're doing this thing. We have this really big customer. I can offer a discount in this type of way. And I can highlight not only my technology, but then also this really large company to show that they're doing something cool within the startup space. And so I haven't really seen those two things done in the other programs the way that Lacey has done it. So that's one of, you know, those are the reasons why we're very grateful for them and really enjoy being a part of the program.
That's so cool. And Alex, this case study is just writing itself now.
It is. But, you know, one of the things that's been a cool byproduct of some of that pilot work is seeing the number of companies in our portfolio who are now starting to contract with each other. Like as you look at cohort two, and I was doing interviews for cohort two, I think at least two or three companies said, oh, and we've already talked to Charger Help. Our plan is to use them for our, you know, operations and maintenance, as part of our operations and maintenance stack. And I was like, oh, that's very interesting. And to see that sort of cross cohort cooperation, if you will. I mean, obviously it's business driven, but it's sort of that, hey, I already know who Camille is because I talked to her about X within Lacey, but now I'm going to actually use Charger Help for some of my operations and maintenance needs.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, thinking about kind of EVs and EV charging big picture. I mean, Alex, I know you and I, whenever we got on the phone, we're just too dorky not to talk about the landscape. And for listeners that don't know, Alex kind of has a cool automotive background in his earlier days. But so, Camille, I'm kind of curious, you know, there's obviously been an explosion in you know, EV and EV charging startups in the last year or so. You know, the space is growing and maturing and changing so fast. Like, where do you see this space going? Like, what's the future of charging look like to you?
Oh my goodness, we talk about this. Well, my number one thing with our industry is to make prettier stations. I am a person of design. I'm just like, the stations should look like the future. So I'm very excited to see where technology takes us and where the design of station now becomes a part of a driver's like normal habits. One of the things that we talk about often is with EV charging, like either it needs to be something that happens that you just, it happens and you don't remember, you know, kind of like pumping gas. I can't, you know, you talk to people, they don't really know when they pumped gas, or it needs to be an extraordinary experience where all you can do is talk about how this new technology has introduced us to the future. And so I really think that at least from the companies that I've seen through Lacey and even Elemental around EV charging, I think that we're pushing towards the space of it being an extraordinary experience. And I think the more founders that we support and give you know, funding to, the more that you'll be able to really see the future, you know, be revealed through our eyes today, and that's what I'm most excited about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I like that kind of analogy that it should be akin to pumping gas where, yeah, last time I filled up a car, I don't know if I went to a Shell or a Chevron, just like, it was just a thing you did and you forget about it as soon as you, you know, wipe your hands off. But I mean, that's one thing that I've also sort of been thinking about in terms of, you know, the recharging, refueling experience. You know, there's kind of been a proliferation of all sorts of different places you can charge where, you know, not only can you charge at work or at your home, but, you know, now there's, you know, you charge at the restaurant, you charge at the retail center, you charge, you know, basically any large parking lot. It seems like there's someone is fighting for that turf to put their chargers there. And I'm just kind of, I mean, I don't want to offend anyone's partners here, but I'm just kind of curious if we're almost going to see like an oversaturation in terms of charging. So, Alex, I know we've chatted about this a little. What do you think about, do you really need to be able to charge when you're at Whole Foods for 30 minutes?
Well, I think the one lesson we always have from big infrastructure expenditures is we don't really know everything until, you know, a decade later. So with a lot of it, when the internet came along, there was a sort of gold rush opportunity to install fiber optic cable under the ocean. And it was only that a decade later when MCI was out of business, but Google was a, you know, or at least probably at the time, Yahoo, not yet Google, was a multi-billion dollar business that everybody realized the direct link between that fiber optic cable being laid under the ground and, you know, MCI potentially no longer being in business, but Yahoo being an unexpectedly huge business that nobody ever really even envisioned necessarily when that fiber optic cable was being laid. So infrastructure investments seem to have one of these lags in our understanding of how important that infrastructure was and what people built on top of that. And I think similarly on EV charging infrastructure, we'll only realize maybe in a decade from now how valuable some of the, even though there are some teething pains today of some charger networks, you know, maybe not being as profitable as people would want. I think we'll look back in a decade from now and just be amazed at the number of things and businesses and opportunities that that infrastructure allowed for. So one thing that, you know, is on the horizon is bidirectional capabilities, right? The ability for cars and buses and whatever to serve as grid resilience services by their ability to actually put energy back into the grid, or at least back into a building, right? Imagine a hospital that might have a rolling blackout, and the ability for a school bus that's EV or a fleet of cars to be able to charge back to the to that hospital to make sure that, or an apartment building that's got a couple people in that who are relying on life-saving medical equipment. So I guess the answer is we don't know yet, but we always know in a decade from now, like all the amazing things people built on top of infrastructure and sort of, you know, Camille and Yvette at Charger Help are building a service business on top of that infrastructure. There may be other software plays, there may be other services plays, et cetera, that we only realize as people progress in this. So I'm long-term, despite some of the short-term hiccups sometimes on people saying, oh, you know, this charger, this one isn't being used as often as it could. One, I think actually Charger Help is figuring out some of those operators why their chargers aren't being used all the time. And two, we'll understand in a decade all the amazing businesses that people were able to build on top of that that really unlock really important markets for us.
I like that a lot. So the analogy of like, you know, what dark fiber was to having all this spare capacity. So all this, you know, conduit and, you know, digging wiring. Yeah, the world's going to need electricity no matter what. So we're laying in the investment for future, you know, innovations. And if we're doing off the back of some VCs, so be it. I think the only question is who's going to be the WorldCom of the current crop of EV companies. But we don't have to decide that on the air now. Camille, I'm kind of curious, you know, we're almost at time, but any kind of, you know, final thoughts on the state of the EV industry from you?
Final thoughts. I just think that there is room for innovation, right? We still haven't figured out everything yet, clearly. And I, on my little soapbox, I think that, you know, we need, you know, more investment dollars from like your South LAs and your rural areas, because you'll get new ideals because folks are coming from a different perspective. Like, we built Charger Hope the way that we built Charger Hope with the focus on equity and jobs, because, you know, my co-founder saw her dad work at a company for like 40 years and never get a pay increase. And for me, you know, I saw my dad build a company and never get backing or wasn't able to expand. Or my mom, who like worked a full-time job and like still had to rely on government assistance. And so that viewpoint allowed us to create a business model that's not only profitable and needed, but most importantly, going to like help tons of people. So I say, keep creating programs like the Lacey's of the world, keep investing in folks that don't normally get invested in, because without doing that, you lose out on ideals. And so that's my little soapbox, Jonah.
No, I couldn't agree more. And yeah, thank you both. Thank you, Camille. And thank you, Alex. It was a real pleasure chatting with you both.
Thank you so much, Jonah.
Well, that was a super fun conversation. As listeners know, EVs are always an important topic here at the Commotion family. And obviously with the, you know, Biden bill and all the infrastructure bills and the machinations only going to continue to get to be a bigger and frothier and more important space, and that kind of land grab over where you charge them and whose network you use is only going to get more important What do you think, Greg?
No, absolutely. I mean, yeah, I mean, it's definitely the year of the charger here. I mean, in addition to, of course, Biden and what that means for EVs, I always come back to our friend Julia Thain, past guest and, you know, over at LA Movement Labs. When she was back at Siemens, she wrote a whole paper that I remember that was the first person to grapple with how much electricity would be needed for this if LA were to meet its sustainability goals. And she calculated at the time that, you know, you would need to increase the electricity generation of Los Angeles by 1,000% to do it. So it's interesting to see people finally waking up to like just the scale it's going to be required to actually, you know, replace all those gas stations and filling points with charging points and everything else. So yeah, I think we're gonna have a lot more to say about this subject in the very near future for sure.
Well, stay tuned, listeners, if you want to hear it here.
Exactly. And you'll hear it at Commotion Miami. This is our reminder for you, for those of you who are listening, to go to commotionmiami.com and register. I believe, of course, we have a free tier. It is, of course, virtual again this year, a hybrid event. If you are in South Florida, there will be options to attend personally. Again, we're working out the various events that will happen live and, you know, intimate dinners, smaller side conversations. There will be, of course, be the formal program that will be happening virtually wherever finer bandwidth is sold. And I would encourage you all to head on over to commotionmiami.com and sign up at whatever tier your heart desires.
See you there.
All right. On that note, thank you all for listening. Thank you for joining, Jonah. And we'll be back next week with another episode of Fast Forward. Until then, take care.